And you know, as you said, Linda, these sounds are popping up all over YouTube, and they've been there for some time, haven't they?
Since the March 11th is the first one that I have been able to find, and we are now in March or February, going soon into
Yep,
March,
almost
so
a
it's
year.
here, but no one was listening to these sounds or talking about them until the montages, the collections, were put together in January, and that's when theories about what was causing these sounds begin to grow like mushrooms, just like what was happening on YouTube. And some of those explanations included things like, well, rocks might be sliding against rocks underground in seismic events, or atmospheric changes caused by increased solar activity interacting with Earth's magnetic fields. And in that last category, at the end of January on the 28th, an alleged Azerbaijan geophysicist named Elchin Khalilov released a web article entitled, quote, "Strange Sounds in Sky Explained by Scientists," close quote. Why he used scientists plural in his title, since he is the lone author, is as puzzling as his alleged hypothesis that the strange global sounds are produced by, quote, acoustic gravity waves caused by powerful solar flares and plasma emissions from the sun as solar activity began to rise sharply since early 2011, close quote. So I contacted David Hathaway, PhD, solar physicist at the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Dr. Hathaway has been predicting for the past year that the 2013 solar maximum will be the weakest in nearly a century. His colleagues at the National Solar Observatory in Tucson, Arizona, have also presented research data that sunspot magnetic fields are weakening by about 50 Gauss per year. Their conclusion is that sunspots could completely vanish around 2015, beginning a Maunder minimum cycle not seen for 300 years since 1715. All this means that, contrary to the Elchin Khalilov web paper, there is nothing especially strong about solar cycle 24 as it moves toward maximum a year from now in the summer of 2013. I began my interview with Dr. Hathaway by playing for him some of the Norway old TV sounds and then the Kiev, Ukraine horn-like sounds. And then I read the opening sentences of Mr. Khalilov's web article that is supposed to explain how the sounds might be produced by solar plasmas and magnetic field interactions. But Dr. Hathaway disagrees. Here now is my interview after playing sounds for NASA solar physicist David Hathaway.
Dr. Hathaway, I'm quoting from Strange Sounds in Sky Explained by Scientists by Mr. Khalilov on January 28, 2012. The article begins, quote, "We have analyzed records of these sounds and found that most of their spectrum lies within the infrasound range, not audible to humans. What people hear is only a small fraction of the actual power of these sounds. They are low-frequency acoustic emissions in the range between 20 and 100 hertz, modulated by ultra-low infrasonic waves from 0.1 to 15 hertz. In geophysics, they are called acoustic gravity waves. They are formed in the upper atmosphere at the atmosphere-ionosphere boundary in particular." Now, that's his lead, and that these low-frequency acoustic emissions and the acoustic gravity waves that they produce are what he is saying is the essence of these sounds. What is your comment, Dr. Hathaway?
The description that you read me, where we call these acoustic gravity waves, it sounded like he was just spouting scientific terms without any real attribution as to this is where the noise is coming from. I'm unaware of any significant sounds coming from aurorae. People in Alaska that have been studying aurorae for decades, I'm sure would have heard them and would have set up microphones in an array so you can pinpoint where is the sound coming from, what is its frequencies that are being produced. Certainly the sound that I heard, that was very much in the audible range. You hear all the city sounds in this
strange horn-like.
Yeah, horn-like, I think, is the correct description. But I really doubt that solar activity producing it. This is the small sunspot cycle. We've had huge sunspot cycles prior to this. You know, so I strongly suspect that this is not the case.
And isn't it true that ultra-low infrasonic is usually what might be associated with solar plasmas interacting with magnetic fields?
Yeah, I mean, big things make low sounds.
Yeah.
So it's called infrasound because it's below the 20 hertz that human ears can hear. As far as solar activity and its effect on the Earth, certainly it produces the ionosphere, produces aurorae, produces a lot of things. If that activity was producing sounds like this, scientists would have been quick to jump on it. I mean, we're curious folks, you know. We've been studying solar activity and aurorae and the ionosphere for a long time now, and I think if sounds like this, if they were associated with it, I'm sure we would have been on top of it a long time ago.
Could you explain what happens on the sun, what leaves the sun, what interacts with Earth's magnetic fields that produces aurora?
The particles that produce aurora come from within the Earth's magnetic field, but they are energized and ultimately produced by disturbances hitting the Earth's magnetic field, and those disturbances come from the sun. So if we start at the sun, we have flares on the surface of the sun that are produced by twisted magnetic fields in sunspots that have blast material off of the sun, a billion tons of matter moving at a million miles an hour in what we call a coronal mass ejection. And so this is a cloud of ionized matter with embedded magnetic fields that's thrown off of the sun through the solar system. And when they're thrown at Earth, coronal mass ejection that's launched from a position that's near the center of the sun as we view it, that coronal mass ejection goes through the solar system in a matter of a couple days, reaches the Earth, and that's where the electrons that produce the aurora come from. They spin around magnetic field lines, and as they come into the atmosphere, they strike nitrogen and oxygen that's in our atmosphere, and if it's high enough up where they hit, they produce the colors. Reds produce real high, and you can often see red aurorae at fairly low latitudes during a big storm.
Why are they high?
Because of the path that the magnetic field lines take. For the electrons to get down low into the atmosphere, it's difficult at lower latitudes just because the magnetic field lines, instead of coming into the atmosphere, are more or less moving along it. They're moving at an angle more parallel to the surface of the Earth instead of coming in through the atmosphere.
Now, some of the most spectacular aurorae photographs, they have had beautiful curves to them. Are we seeing the curves of the magnetic fields?
Yeah, very much so. It's what the electrons streaming down. And so depending upon which field lines they'll come down, they're often like curtains. And the one or two I've seen, they look like curtains that are continually moving around. And it's because the electrons are coming down on different magnetic field lines as they stream into the atmosphere.
So is it fair for me as a reporter to say that acoustic gravity waves could not explain the horn-like sounds in the Kiev, Ukraine video or the strange up-and-down white noise in the Norway video?
It's highly unlikely. The acoustic waves and the gravity waves that are produced within the Earth's atmosphere are produced by atmospheric phenomena. As a solar and space scientist, I'm more concerned about trying to attribute those noises to solar activity. That's where I think... No, I think they're really off on the wrong foot there. Certainly something is making those noises. I'm just incredulous about the possibility that it's solar activity that's producing them.
So in all of your work as a solar physicist, you have never heard of anyone anywhere on the planet hearing or recording sounds from plasmas interacting with the Earth's magnetic fields?
actual acoustic sounds. I don't know of any scientific studies that say there was this aurora and we detected these sounds from that aurora. Certainly there are lots of disturbances that are produced by aurora, by lightning in the Earth's atmosphere and so forth. Lightning, of course, we hear thunder. So there's no doubt that lightning produces sound. But it also produces disturbances along these magnetic field lines that you can hear it via radio. Old AM and certainly in shortwave radio transmissions, you can hear at radio frequencies these disturbances moving around in the Earth's magnetic field.
And it sounds like a lot of static, doesn't it?
Well, it sounds like static, but the interesting one are what are called whistler modes. As the magnetic field lines go into the North and South Pole, they get closer and closer together and they get stronger. And it makes the electrons that are moving along those field lines produce radio waves at different frequencies. And so what you can hear it when you're listening to a radio, you'll often hear what are called whistler modes. It'll sound like someone whistling, but with a pitch changing. Things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's whistler modes. There's roaring that sounds like noise. There's a lot of noise that you hear at radio frequencies that does come from these electrons moving around in the Earth's magnetic field.
Is there anything that is going on with the sun and this solar system that might be different now in 2011 to 2012 than has ever been between the sun and the solar system before? Is there any anomaly that you all have even had curiosity about?
Not that I can think of. Nothing. Everything's pretty much as it was.
So we truly have a mystery about what would be producing horn-like sounds and strange white noise, staticky, loud sounds around the world in just the last year. What if it is a real phenomenon, others' white noise, are being generated at certain latitudes and longitudes for reasons unknown?
Then it would be really interesting.
That's why I'm trying to figure out what is going on. Exactly. What is the current status from your point of view of the activity of the sun and the relationship to that controversial question, will this be a strong solar max or a weak one?
We are approaching maximum. I still suspect and predicting that maximum will be about the middle of next year, 2013, and that it's going to be a smaller than average cycle.
You still think that?
I still do.
So why are we getting all of these strong solar flares that are producing what some people who live in the Arctic and Norway and that area say are the most astounding aurora they've ever seen?
I haven't heard that. Certainly there's been some spectacular aurorae, but the number of flares, the number of aurorae is totally in line with the size of the cycle as we see it. Since we had this long lull of little activity, we've gotten very excited when the sun does produce things. And forget that 10, 12 years ago, we were seeing very much the same sort of activity.
And it was about a decade ago that we were in a solar max that had a lot of big flares. Well, 2 weeks ago, NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center released its monthly update of the ongoing solar cycle 24 sunspot activity that was covering January of 2012. And just like the month before in December, the solar sunspot numbers plunged to a low that has not been seen since March of 2011. And over the past year, the sun's activity has fluctuated from strong to weak at least four times since the fall of 2010. To have such low sunspot activity now, as maximum is supposed to be revving up, means that Dr. Hathaway's prediction is holding up, that the solar cycle 24 maximum next summer of 2013 could be the weakest in nearly a century. And so you put all this together, and it makes me wonder what in the world provoked that Kalilov web paper that was not based in any physics associated with the known sun and the known magnetic fields interaction now whatsoever. And it also stresses for me as a reporter that we might be in 2012, all of us, having to do overtime work separating the wheat from the chaff. And in this case, the chaff could be everything from government projects that are deliberately trying to do tests in this sort of mythological year of 2012 that some people think will be apocalyptic and others think will just be another year that transitions to 2013 with that being a solar max year, but perhaps a very weak solar max, interestingly enough, going in perhaps, if some of these other physics projections are correct, into a Maunder minimum by 2015, in which there would be no sunspots on the sun for some foreseeable future. And who knows what that would do. But you take all of this and you and look at all of the different possibilities out there from, we'll call them formal counterintelligence tests, to people who just want to pull pranks, to something truly unusual and highly strange happening in the unseen, perhaps related to some sort of interaction with the big cosmic box and our small solar system, and that we are truly in a year where everybody, all of us, we have to be helping each other do reality checks on what are facts and separate them from forces that may be trying to manipulate human minds for reasons unknown, while at the same time, we can't be throwing out the truly mysterious. And I hope, George, as we go through 2012, that what I'm doing with my Earth Files news reports on Coast and at earthfiles.com, that people will come to Earth Files and listen to the Earth Files news on Coast as an effort to try to separate out what is truly happening. And right now, I can say tonight, I have too many emails from too many people that are all over the United States and the world who are reporting. They're baffled. There's no question that they are baffled.
And they are hearing something.
And right? They are hearing something, but why isn't the whole planet? Why aren't whole cities? Why aren't whole neighborhoods? That, to me, makes that whole DARPA research project so interesting. What could be putting a carrier wave on microwaves and perhaps aiming them in a tight focus? That's something for us all to learn a lot more about. And to remember that Will Smith, delivering his newspapers in Olive Branch, Mississippi, a suburb of Memphis, Tennessee, that when that sound filled the air, the hair on his head, the hair on his arms started rising. That is an electrostatic effect. It means that there is something that is charged in the atmosphere, was charged around Will Smith. It made him feel eerie, and it means that some true electrostatic physical phenomena was occurring around him when he heard the horn-like sound.
I know the first Monday of every month at 11 o'clock in St. Louis, Linda, they play sirens for tornado drills, basically. But I mean, clearly you can hear that. But my point, it's so eerie when you hear these sounds throughout the area and you just don't know exactly where they're coming from.
And if you listen to that Kiev, Ukraine, in all of its 11 minutes and 24 seconds, and realize that variations on that sound have been being heard everywhere from the United States, Canada, Germany, all over, and Australia, then what in the world would be the motive? That really intrigues me.
Dolphins. I love them. Linda talks about them next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we call it Conversations with Linda. That's right. We take your phone calls, questions for her. Perhaps you're a whistleblower and you've got some story ideas and tips. Many of our stories that we've had with Linda have come from you. We'll do that next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Linda, every time I see a story about a dolphin dying or beaching itself, it just drives me crazy.
I know. I love them so much. And of all of the dolphins, this one that has been coming into Cape Cod in unprecedented numbers and dying in unprecedented numbers over 4 weeks, January, it started January 12th, and the last stranding of 11 was the 14th, for a total of 179 in the Cape Cod area between Barnstable and Wellfleet, of which 108 died.
Jeez.
And these are all common dolphins. And I'll give you just a little background because they are so beautiful. There are now thought to be perhaps three species, one that has a short beak, one that has a long beak, and one that is in the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean that has an extremely long and thin beak. And these are the dolphins that have the beautiful bodies where the back is dark, the belly is white, and then along each side, it is like a kind of long hourglass in which the upper part of the hourglass can be beige, yellow, or gold, and the back of the hourglass is this light gray. I have some beautiful photographs at Earth Files of them, and then some sad and tragic ones of the people that have been trying to save their lives. The common dolphins like deep, warmer waters between about 40 degrees north and 50 degrees south.
That was Flipper was one of those, right?
I think Flipper was a bottlenosed dolphin.
Bottlenose. Okay.
Yeah. These are the ones you see in all the old Greek art, are the common dolphin. And the irony is they're called common dolphin because they have such a long history on the earth, but there is so little known about them because they like to stay out in deep, warm water. They have know that these animals will dive down 700 feet going after food, and that they live in large social groups of maybe 100 or 1,000. And the common dolphins were abundant in the Mediterranean Sea until the 1960s. And then their population began to seriously decline, perhaps from toxins, industrial pollution, fishing nets, climate change, and other human assaults on the marine environment. In the United States, common dolphins are a protected species. Now, they also, the common dolphin, navigates and finds its food by making burst pulses, which is the clicking sound that travels quickly through the water. And the sound is bounced back from the objects in front of the dolphin into the dolphin's head and its lower jaw that has a kind of fatty tissue specially made to process the returns of these clicking sounds, similar to human radar or sonar. The dolphin echolocation clicks are some of the loudest sounds made by all marine animals. And beginning on January 12th, a month ago, and up to February 14th, 179 of these beautiful common dolphins came into that hook at Cape Cod, and they stranded, and then they re-stranded, and 108 died over that period of time. And the reasons for the persistent common dolphin strandings are still unclear as I am speaking tonight. Rescue teams from the International Fund for Animal Welfare, also known as IFAW in Yarmouthport, Massachusetts, tried to save as many of the common dolphins as possible as they kept persisting to strand, re-strand, and die between Barnstable and Wellfleet. IFAW contacted the United States Navy about possible underwater sound interference from military projects off Cape Cod, but the Navy said it was not conducting any exercises or other projects that might have interfered with the common dolphin, let's say its echolocation. The process, maybe there was interference, and maybe that's what threw off their navigation. No one knows. One marine biologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Marine Fisheries Service is Trevor Spradlin. He has studied dolphins and marine mammals for 23 years. After undergraduate work in marine biology at Boston University in 1991, Trevor began working for the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Cape Cod. His focus was marine mammal behavior and the bioacoustics lab research. Then, in 1994, he took a position at NOAA in the Marine Mammal Health and Stranding Response Program in Silver Spring, Maryland. I talked with him last week after 11 common dolphins stranded in Cape Cod on February 14th. And Trevor told me that with 179 strands, 108 deaths, quote, this is an unprecedented number in such a short time, close quote. Here now is Trevor Spradlin from NOAA Fisheries.
This is a very perplexing event. We don't know why it's been persisting for the past 4 weeks. What is different about this event is the longevity of it and certainly the numbers. We are perplexed by the large volume of animals that we're seeing. But common dolphins, we do know, live in very large groups. And when they're off in deep water, they can form huge groups of hundreds of animals. We don't know very much about the social dynamics of common dolphins, but we're slowly learning. One of the important things that IFAW has been able to accomplish is they've been able to tag animals that they've been able to release back into the deep water. And so they're able to track the movements of these surviving animals. Some of these animals that IFAW has released, they've been already tracked off the coast of Maine. So they're moving large distances in very short amount of time.
Is it fair to say that this is an unprecedented stranding event in the history of common dolphin strandings?
Definitely. Our colleagues have not seen something at this scale before. These animals seem to be healthy because there is no sign of disease. These animals do not appear to be sick. It's very strange, for sure. Some have restranded again, so we're looking at that.
Restranding means that these are dolphins that have come into Cape Cod, they've been alive, people have tried to get them back out into deep ocean, but they've ended up, because they have them tagged, they know it's the same dolphin, ends up back in Cape Cod.
Exactly.
And that goes to the question of what would be disorienting the common dolphin that normally spends its life out 20 to 30 miles offshore in deep waters. What could make it change twice coming into the Cape Cod hook?
That's a great question. We don't know the answer to that yet. Those animals that restrand are already compromised by the initial stranding event. So some of them may still be in shock. They may still not have recovered from that initial stranding. So why the animals are restranding could be multiple reasons. It could be any myriad of factors. They could be chasing prey, and their prey may be coming inland, and they may be just following their prey. So we are going to be looking at the movement patterns of their prey species and seeing if we can see a pattern there. They could be responding to different shifts in water temperature or currents. We're looking at that as well. The folks on the ground are trying to get to these animals as fast as possible. Just because of the treacherous nature of the habitat there, these animals are being found in remote parts of the Cape. Sometimes these animals have been stranded for quite a while before the rescue team has been able to find them. So if the team is able to get to the animals immediately before they strand, they have a higher probability of survival. If the animals have been on the ground and out of water for an extended period of time, their prognosis for survival is less. Mm-hmm. But they try to make sure that they release as many animals as possible. Some of these restranders are most likely animals that were compromised more than the healthier ones.
Does restranding happen often?
If the animals are showing signs of disease or illness, then restrandings would not be unexpected. But if animals are not showing any signs of disease or have not been exposed to pollution or have not been exposed to sounds that disorient them, then we wouldn't expect them to necessarily restrand unless they've experienced some kind of initial trauma from the first stranding event.
But to date, as we're talking on February 17th, 2012, there's nothing in the necropsies done so far on some of the dead stranded common dolphins in Cape Cod as a specific cause of the stranding and the deaths?
That is correct. These dolphins, when the team is able to handle them, they appear healthy. The live animals, if they are able to get them on the ocean side of the Cape, and put them back into deep water, they seem to be thriving and they seem to be able to survive. the animals that have died have shown no indication of being ill. When they die, it's most likely a result of shock, so being out of the water. What's happening is that these animals are stranding on the bay side of Cape Cod. They are experiencing very extreme shifts in the tide. They find themselves high and dry, and particularly for dolphins, they need to be in water. When they are on land, unfortunately, they succumb to gravity. Their bodies are not designed to withhold their weight, so they need to be in water to have that kind of buoyancy. So when they are on land, it's very detrimental for them, and that's why it's always important to try to get to stranded live animals as fast as possible so that we can try to get them back in the deeper water and have them float and hopefully stabilize. This particular species, common dolphin, is a pelagic deep water species. They are not used to being in shallow waters at all. And one of the predominant theories here is that they are unable to navigate successfully in these very treacherous, shallow areas around the inside of the Cape.
Is it possible that the U.S. Navy could be conducting some kind of underwater exercises that they are not admitting that could interfere with the sonar echolocation of the common dolphins?
Well, we don't think so, because we have been coordinating with the Navy and asking them to provide us information, and they have told us that they're not doing anything out there, and if they were, we would expect to see other species, not just common dolphins, responding to that. We don't see any evidence of noise or acoustic trauma on these animals. They seem to be healthy. They don't seem to be showing any signs of trauma. So it's really perplexing what is going on here.
Could you explain how dolphins use magnetic fields for their orientation and what magnetic anomalies can do to them and how?
Well, the science is still very much ongoing with respect to that. I'm not aware of any definitive work that's been done. I mean, there's mostly just theories about the influence of geomagnetic forces on their ability to navigate. What we do know is that dolphins use a lot of acoustics to find their way through the environment. Particularly common dolphins use echolocation, biological sonar, which they use sound to bounce off objects and to bounce off the seafloor, and that we believe is one of the primary ways that they are able to navigate.
So what might interfere with their echolocation, cause disorientation, and have them end up in the Cape Cod hook?
We don't really know. We will be looking at whether there have been any sounds going on, but we have no evidence to suggest that there are any human-caused sounds, no shipping noise or military noise that has been causing this. But because we're not seeing any immediate signs of illness, disease, pollution, toxicity, we're seeing no overarching health issues with these animals. It's a real mystery why this is happening.
Jeez, another baffling story, Linda.
It is. It truly is. And today I got an update from IFA in Massachusetts. They've completed 9 dolphin necropsies in which the time of death was known, which is important, and several other necropsy results are pending. So far, the necropsy results do not, quote, suggest any one cause for this stranding event. One animal showed gross signs of liver disease. Many otherwise healthy animals showed only signs of stress related to the stranding event itself. Furthermore, there is no gross evidence suggesting that acoustic trauma is a cause for this stranding event, close quote. Searching for viruses and other pathogens can cost a lot of money, in the thousands of dollars, and IFA is seeking more funding for more analysis. 3 days before the large stranding of the 11 common dolphins in Cape Cod on Valentine's Day, on Saturday, February 11th, a 3-year-old body of a female orca killer whale washed up north of Long Beach, Washington. The orca are toothed whales in the oceanic dolphin family, and they are an endangered species. So the loss of this female, known to Cascadia research scientists as L-112 from the L-pod, is very serious. And one of the orca network people, Susan Berta, said, quote, to lose a three-year-old is very sad, but especially when it's a female, and especially from LPOD, this is pretty devastating in a community of marine animals that is so small in numbers, close quote. And right now, the total number of the monitored orca pods on the West Coast, known as KL and J, are only 88 now. The good news is, as of today, February 23rd, going into the 24th, it appears that the last stranding was that February 14th of the 11. They haven't had, between the 14th and this tonight, they haven't had more. They're holding their breath. They're hoping that the long 4 weeks of sustained stranding there is over, even if they don't know what in the world has happened. And this same week, at the annual American Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting in Vancouver, BC, Canada, Professor Lori Marino, PhD, she's in the neuroscience and behavioral biology department at Atlanta's Emory University. She presented a declaration of rights for cetaceans, whales, and dolphins. Professor Marino said, based on her own research, that, quote, science has shown us that cetaceans have most, if not all, the characteristics the humans have, including intelligence, self-awareness, autonomy, and social complexity. Their basic needs are very much like humans: to be able to stay alive, to not be confined, to make choices and travel, and perhaps foremost, to engage in social interaction, close quote. Dolphin brain power is second only to humans on this planet. Dolphins use tools to catch fish. They understand words. They speak in different dialects in different locations. They feed their sick pod mates, and they grieve in sadness when calves die. Professor Marino told the AAAS scientists, quote, if these cetacean animals are self-aware, have specific cultures, stay with the same pod their whole life, and are incredibly intelligent and social, then no tank will ever be able to give them the kind of life they have in the ocean, close quote. Professor Marino and her colleague Annalise Sorg, president of the Coalition for No Whales in Captivity, they want to prevent whales and dolphins from being captured for aquariums or caught for food, and plan to take their declaration of rights for cetaceans to the United Nations. That, to me, is a small light at the end of the tunnel of what humans are doing to Earth life.
All these things going on. Linda, we're going to take phone calls with you next hour. Conversations with Linda. Did you see that story where a Japanese firm wants to build a space elevator by 2050?
Yes, and I would like to talk with some physicists about whether it's feasible.
That would be, it's kind of weird to think of it. It's a long cable, right, that goes up into space.
I saw the illustrations, and I read probably what you read, but I had 1,000 questions running through my mind about, is this really feasible, and how would it work? So that is something I'll get into and maybe do a report about.
Yeah, that would be strange. What would happen, for example, if a plane came by and clipped it?
Yeah, how would you project from the ground to up toward the moon or to the moon?
Very strange. Well, we're going to take a lot of calls already. People are calling. They might have many questions or stories about these strange hums all over the place that could be just about anything. We'll talk about that too, Linda, when we come back. Let's speculate a little bit. I mean, are they building bunkers underneath the old planet? Who knows? Are they coming from extraterrestrial sources? Are they some kind of death ray or some kind of equipment that might be tested on us? Is it biblical? We'll be back in a moment with your calls and Linda Moultonhowe on Coast to Coast AM.